that was what that particular study was. And this is one of the first places that I zoned in on. One of the things that I noticed really early on, we've already talked about, and that is that so much of the Bible story revolves around the family. Remember with Adam and Eve, they ate the fruit. That was the sin. But what structure broke down in that sin? What God-made institution broke down when they ate the fruit? Yeah, the family, right? I mean, God specifically told Adam, because you listened to the voice of your wife over me, you know, this is what's happened to you. Cain and Abel, what broke down in that sin? Yeah, the brotherhood, the family, you know. Throughout Scripture, we see the family taking a central point of God's inspired word to us. And this is no exception. These love stories that we're going to look at tonight, they have to deal with family, and I think that you'll probably see some application both to your dating relationships, if you're dating, your marriages, if you're married, and you know your entire family in general, because they really reach beyond just dating and marriage. Now, like I mentioned, Abraham's faith in God played into this, because at Isaac's marriage, and granted, culturally, we would do this very differently than Abraham did. Still applies, though. What was Abraham's concern with Isaac's marriage?
Make sure he got his own kid.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I don't understand. He came from Gentile people anyway.
Mm-hmm. Worship idols.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess you could say heathen or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that I was just wondering that this afternoon, too. Because there's not really a lot of scriptural evidence that Abraham's family back home was more faithful than the Canaanites.
Well, there's more scripture that says that they worship idols.
Mm-hmm. We do read, and we're actually going to read more in a minute about them worshiping idols. But Abraham at least felt like Isaac had a better shot at a God-glorifying marriage.
I guess he knew the bloodline.
Yeah, that's true. But why else? There was another reason, too. Well, not another reason. Another thing that Abraham made his servant promise not to do. Don't take him back. And why? Yeah, because this was God's promise. God's promise will happen here. So even in initiating this marriage, and Jack, I think the best answer I thought of was there probably just wasn't a better option. You know, but even in initiating this relationship, Abraham's focus was on what's good for God's, what's God's promise, you know, what's going to make that happen. So he told his servant, go back. This brings us to something, and this is something I came up with. You certainly don't have to use this, but I call it in my head the 8 P's of a successful relationship, and we'll look at that in a second. The other thing that was key to this marriage between Isaac and Rebecca was the faith of the servant whom Abraham sent. Now again, today, in dating relationships, in marriage relationships, what typically doesn't happen, I've never heard at least of a father sending a servant to go find, not in our culture. That happens in some cultures, but not in our culture. However, I think you'll see in a minute that these things apply perfectly to any relationship we want to be successful. Which, by the way, I didn't just choose that word at random. Look at verse 12, and anybody who'd like to, just read verse 12. So the servant went into this praying for success, right? Praying for a successful union for Isaac. Which brings us to question two. Question two on the chapter 24 through 35 worksheet was describe how the servant found a wife for Isaac. He prayed for help. Yep. Yeah, he asked for a sign or a plan, and God answered it.
The jar, let down the jar for the drink, you know, so he would have a sign.
Uh-huh.
He looked for the one that was showing kindness.
Yep. Essentially, this is the rest of chapter 24. Which, just to summarize really briefly, he said the prayer we looked at. He had a plan. He asked for a sign. Before he finished speaking, Rebekah came and fulfilled that sign. The sign that he asked for specifically was that, let me get his words. Let the young woman to whom I say, please let down your jar that I may drink. This is verse 14. And who says, drink and I will water your camels as well. Let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master. So that was the sign. Rebekah came, he said, let me have some drink, and she said, let me have some water, and she said, yeah, sure, I'll give you water and your camels as well. Then in verse 21, the man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. In verse 26, the man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord. he meets her family, and they encourage him to eat in verse 33, and he said, I'm not going to eat basically until I've done what I've came to do. Then in verse verse 50. They agree to send Rebekah with him, and they request that he give her some time, I guess, to say goodbye is kind of what I got from it. But he answered in verse 56, don't delay me. The Lord has prospered me. Let's seal this. Let's get this done. So Rebekah consented, and they went with her. Now, like I said, I came up with just a way to help think about relationships, at least for me, and this is... I word this in 8 P's. The 8 P's of successful relationships. This works for dating. This works for marriage. This works for difficult family situations. And I'll tell you what I mean. In verse 10, like we said, he prayed for success. Or he prepared. He made a plan. Then he said a prayer for success and continued that plan in verse 14. He pursued the outcome of the plan, pondered in verse 21, and just stopped and thought. Then he praised God, persisted after the plan, looked like it had been successful, and that led to the prosperity of the plan. Lots of P's. But let me explain a couple situations in which you can see this working. So, for example, let's take dating Tom. 19-year-old dating Tom. This was years before I'd met Amelia. And actually, these principles helped me have a successful relationship with Amelia. Which, the way that I define a successful relationship is one that gets your family to heaven. And granted, we're pretty newlywed, but these have helped us a lot so far. When I was baptized, changed the way I thought about dating, I prepared myself to be a good Christian. Can't really expect to marry a good Christian if you're not ready to be one. Some people get lucky and they're able to, or blessed, I guess is a better word there. But, you know, you should try to be the right kind of Christian. Prayed a lot. And I planned for a relationship to have success, planned for things like studying with my significant other. In this case, it wound up being Amelia. Now, once that happened, a plan is one thing, right? But then you have to carry out a plan. And it's really easy once you get into a relationship to kind of fall out of love with God as you fall more and more into love with that person. So it's important to, even like this servant, you know, he didn't just make the plan, ask for a sign, and then say, hey, cool, I got a sign, let's roll with it. But he pursued that plan, and I love verse 21. Because God, I mean, think about this. He said, God, let the woman who comes and gives me a drink and my camels, let her be the one. And then God sent Rebekah, and she gave him a drink and his camels with the exact wording that he asked for. And it says, still, he sat and thought. Why? You guys have to arm wrestle. That's the rule.
Yeah. He's just making sure that watch her closely, make sure whether or not the Lord had made his journey successful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Is that where?
Things don't happen that fast most of the time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, first time.
That's true. That was good. You know, and really, it's especially in terms of a relationship, it's good every once in a while just to stop and think. You know, especially if you're not married yet, if you're dating, it's good to just stop and think, hey, you know, I know that I've been working hard and trying to pursue this God's way, but is this still working out God's way? Are we still in love with God? Are we still glorifying him and getting each other to heaven? Then, after the marriage was pretty well sealed, I mean, at this point, they'd made the agreement for Rebekah to go back and be with Isaac. He didn't wait for food. He didn't stay the night. He persisted in carrying this out, and he was granted success. Now, in marriage, the same thing is true. Once you've become married, the same thing is true. If you apply this to any marital problem, it might not solve it, Nothing is really that easy. But it'll certainly help handle it in a godly manner. You know, thinking about the process of faith that the servant took. And with dealing with family, even family you're not married to, but just difficult family, you know, preparing and planning and pursuing it in a godly manner and then praising him when it's successful, that'll help a lot with any number of family situations. And I want us to look at the result of this faith. Let me get a volunteer to read verses 62. Let's just do 62 through 66.
Now Isaac had come from Beer, I don't know how to say that, where he was living in the Negev. He went out to the field one evening to meditate, and as he looked up, he saw camels approaching. Rebekah also looked up and saw Isaac. She got down from her camel and asked the servant, "Who is that man in the field coming to meet us? He is my master." The servant answered, so she took her veil and covered herself. Then the servant told Isaac all he had done. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah. So she became his wife, and he loved her, and Isaac was comforted after his mother's death.
If you could put all of your imaginative power into that understated end of that story, it would probably not be anywhere close to what Isaac and Rebekah actually experienced and felt. I mean, even the little wording that we have, Nicholas Sparks couldn't have written it better. He's the guy who does all those like notebook movies, right? Okay, all right, yeah. He couldn't have written this better. I mean, he's meditating in the field, probably praying, you know, and he looks up and he sees his wife coming, and she looks up and she sees him. And when she realizes it's him, she prepares herself to be a wife, puts on her veil. And then I think the last verse there is especially powerful. He loved her, and Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. See, that's like exactly what a marriage is supposed to be, isn't it? Again, this is the newlywed phase. Isaac and Rebekah are up for a bit of a bumpy road. But, I mean, this is exactly what a marriage is supposed to be. Why did God create marriage in the first place? Why did he create Eve? Yep. To solve the problem of man being alone, to help. You know, and now that we're no longer in the garden, what is the help that men need? Companionship. I'll tell you what, if you're a dad in here, raise your hand if you would want to raise your family alone. Now raise your hand if you're grateful if you have a wife to help you do it. Getting your family to heaven, you know? And that's what we see here. Isaac taking comfort after the death of his mother. Painful experience that apparently he was suffering from.
Rebecca deserves some praise here. You know, through that, you know, her mother and brother, they kind of changed her mind a little bit, wanted her to stay a little longer. And, you know, the servant said, "No, I really need to take him back to my master." And they said, "Well, let's ask her, will you go?" And she said, "Yes." And then, you know, when she sees that this is the master coming out, as we read in 64 there, you know, she covers her, she's taking all the precautions and making sure that she does everything properly, and I think it speaks highly of her. You know, here, she's just sitting there one day, and here this stranger comes up. Now, she's going to be married to somebody she's never even seen, but she seems to know how it's supposed to go, and she's a willing participant and ready. And I just kind of feel like maybe she has some faith in the Lord that, you know, this is going to be a better thing for her.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably right, especially because the decision seems to come down to her to leave that night or leave the next day, and she says, "Let's go."
I think, though, Laban is a little bit like his grandson, a little bit deceitful.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have fun with Laban.
There's a little bit of a hidden story in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
I can't. Let's see. Yeah, we should get to Laban tonight. Yep. All right. The next great love story here is one of brotherly love. But before we get there, let's run through these questions, if you don't mind, really briefly. So, If you don't get a chance to correct any answers or change any answers or anything while we're going through them, just let me know. We kind of left off on question three. In chapter 25 and verse 9, where was Abraham buried and who buried him?
Machpelah by Isaac and Ishmael.
Yes, sir. His two sons. In 25, 19 through 28, what were Isaac's first two sons' names? What did their names mean? And what were they both good at? As well as which one was whose favorite?
Esau and Jacob.
Esau and Jacob? What did Esau mean?
Yep,
Red and Harry and Jacob meant deceiver. What were they good at? What was their proficiencies?
Esau, outdoors.
That's right, Esau was a hunter. Jacob?
He was good at deceiving.
That's true. That wasn't what I put, but that's true. That's correct. What was another one of his proficiencies?
He liked to stay around with mom.
Yep, seems to be a bit of a mama's boy. He liked to stay in the tents and be busy about the tents. Who was whose favorite? Which one did Isaac favor?
Esau.
Isaac liked Esau better. Rebecca liked Jacob better. Yep. All right.
See, that creates a problem anyway.
Mm-hmm. There's that family coming up again. Yep.
Yeah, over the weekend at this funeral that I did Saturday, a woman said, this is her daddy's favorite daughter.
Oh.
That's always. I mean, the other daughter wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
When you play with one child and another, you get to
create a big problem. Yep, that's conflict a coming.
We'll see it in this.
Mm-hmm. Actually, question five is right along those lines. How did Esau lose his birthright?
Some stew.
Yep, he gave it up for some stew.
For a belly, empty belly.
Yeah. What did Isaac do in 26, 6 through 11? And I should have worded this differently, but where could he have learned the behavior that he... Yep, lied about his wife to Abimelech to try and keep himself safe.
Abraham.
And he probably learned it, if not seeing it in Abraham, which it doesn't appear that he would have, at least hearing about it from people or Abraham himself. Describe how Jacob got Isaac's blessing. He deceived his dad, and how angry was Esau about it?
Angry enough to want to kill him.
Yep, chapter 27, verse 41 says Esau hated Jacob.
Some help from his mother, though, too. She kind of forced him, and it wasn't. He didn't think of this as self-out.
Doesn't look like. It looks like his mom was fanning the flame a little, or a lot. Yep. And actually, I'll circle this. We'll pause there and dive into the text a little bit more. Because I think that's probably about as far as we'll get tonight anyway. So, like we kind of went over in the questions, Jacob and Esau were born, and this, you know, the story of their birth of, you know, Esau, Rebekah had a struggle within her as they were being born, and Esau came out, he was red and hairy. I called him Esau, because I think that name sounds like the word for red. Then Jacob was born holding on to his heel, which is amazing for a baby. He was just clamped on there, not going to let him get out first, so they named him Jacob, which meant usurper or
deceiver.
Yes, sir. Now, the birthright thing, oh, we are already, I got ahead on my slides. But the birthright was a really important tradition, and I don't know, actually it was more like a law than a tradition. And I, at this point, I'm not positive that it was the same birthright that was in that we find in Deuteronomy. It could be, this could be where it's instituted or begun, but at any rate, at this point in history, the birthright probably meant three big things. One that I think we all know is probably the most common one, but the son, the firstborn son, would receive a greater portion. In this case, because there's two, be a double portion. If there were more, that portion might be differently divided, but they would receive a much greater portion of property and wealth and I mean everything that the father had, which was a big deal because at this time, it's not like they were the United States of America. They were the United States of whoever the patriarch was. You know what I mean? Like in this case, the United States of Isaac. So the son got the bigger part of his father's clan or tribe or nation. Which then brings us to the patriarch. Apparently, and there's a little bit of debate about whether or not the blessing and the birthright were separate things, but just for tonight's sake, we're going to lump them together. They would get a blessing from the patriarch that was special, you know, which is going to come up later. And then on top of that, this third one isn't so much a gift as it is like a responsibility. they would get the mantle of being the patriarch of the family after the father died, which meant that they would be the judge of the family, they'd be the jury of the family, they were the head of the family after that patriarch died. So, like we reviewed here in chapter 25, let me have a volunteer just read verses 29 through the end of the chapter. 29 through 34. Yes, sir. 25, 29 through 34.
Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That's why he's also called Edom. Jacob replied, "First sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright.
So what was the underlying problem of this situation?
He was hungry.
Okay, that is a problem.
So he's in duress.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also a problem.
But the birthright doesn't mean anything to him. He says, "What is it to me?"
Boom. He despised his birthright. Yes, sir. You know, I mean, his parents were playing favorites. Sure. And he was hungry. Yes. And then he's probably being a little dramatic. I mean, his reasoning essentially is, "What good is a birthright to me if I die from hunger?" But let's just assume that he really was, like, near starvation.
Being a hunter, too, it's surprising that he would be that hungry.
Yeah. He must have had a bad day, you know. Yeah.
But if he could hunt, he could also roast.
Yep. At the root of it all was just the fact that he took the legacy of his dad, of his father, and his God-given birthright, took it lightly, didn't value it. And this leads to the upcoming conflict in this particular this leg, I guess, of the love story. So we're going to skip a little bit in the narrative. We're going to come back in probably next week, we're going to come back to Jacob and Leah and Rachel. But just really briefly summarize it. Jacob goes to Laban, and Laban proves to be every bit as deceitful as Jacob, like Jack mentioned. Laban's a really fun character. He tricks Jacob into marrying his older daughter, who apparently was not attractive first. Then he tricks Jacob into working another 7 years, so 14 years of labor, to get the woman that Jacob actually loved, Rachel. Then Rachel and Leah use children as like a bargaining tool. At one point, it even comes down to them bartering over who gets to lay with Jacob by selling mandrakes to each other. So they're, you know, this family is already fraught with some division, some favoritism even. And so as all of that is happening, Jacob finally decides in chapter 31 that Laban, his father-in-law, no longer values him enough to stay in Laban's household. So Jacob decides to go back home, and God tells him to go back home. I'm just going to blank that out for a second. So God tells him to go back home there in chapter 31 and verse 3. The Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers, to your kindred, and I will be with you." Now, it's been at least 14 years, right? He worked 7 years for Leah, 7 more years for Rachel. It had been at least 14 years. But what did Jacob have to fear back home? Yep, his brother Esau. I mean, remember, he was sent to Laban, and I didn't mention this. We'll get more into this next week. But he was sent to Laban because his mom said, "Esau will kill him if he stays here, so let's send him to Laban to find a wife." You know, for her, it was like a win-win, save his life and find a wife. So he went to Laban. Esau hated him enough to kill him, went to Laban, and now 14 years later, Laban doesn't favor him anymore. Probably because he was being deceitful to Laban as well. They were just dishing it back and forth. And also because God in verse 2 there told him it was time to go back. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah, and I think that this is one of those turning points in Jacob's faith. In look at chapter 35 in verse 7. In chapter 35 and verse 7, God blesses Jacob and told him to go, you know, worship him, make an altar. Oh, here it is in verse 4. So before Jacob went to make this altar, someone read verse 4.
So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods they had and the rings in their ears, and Jacob buried them under the oak at Shechem.
Now this is apparently the same oak or terebinth that we've read about in Genesis 12 and verse 6. So before Jacob really comes before God, he buried all these idols. He got rid of all these idols. Hopefully Abraham and Isaac. You know, and again, we do see that same lesson. You know, faith is a growth process. So we're going to have to pause here for tonight, halfway through the brotherly love story. So I'm going to circle question 8, and we'll pick up there next Wednesday. If you need help with any of these questions, just let me know. But really, they're not meant to be ones where you have to have a specific answer. And we'll pick up here next week. Are there any comments or questions about what we went over tonight?